What does the positive culture look like to you?
Yeah, it is a culture based on largely based on respect, and respecting individuals, respecting diversity, respecting the fact that not everybody thinks the same. And it's also based on humble leadership, servant leadership, where leaders get away from telling people what to do to asking people, hey, what do you think about? How should this be done? You're the expert on this. Tell me, and I support you, kind of culture. That, to me, helped get me started on it. Mm-hmm. It was especially the respect part. Yes, you can engage people by telling them what to do and creating fear so they do it. But you can also engage people by respecting them respecting them for their knowledge, for their experience, and let them come up with a way of doing things.
Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high performance organization, with your host, Joseph Paris.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. Today, my guest is Norbert Margeris. Norbert is a veteran of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, who retired after almost 40 years with the company and where he completed his career there as lead lean transformation champion. Not being one to stay idle, Norbert then started his consultancy where he shares his experiences to help other companies. He's also a Shingo Academy Fellow and the author of two books, Lean Driven Innovation, Powering Product Development at the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, and his latest work, Winning Innovation, How Innovation Excellence Propels an Industry Icon Towards Sustained Prosperity. Welcome, Norbert. Welcome to State of Readiness. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm pretty good, and thanks for inviting me. I love to these opportunities to share my thinking about a very important subject.
Yeah, well, we've been in each other's orbits for quite some time, and I have to thank you for prodding Billy Ray Taylor to come on to my podcast. It was quite an interesting conversation he and I had. He's had a tremendous journey also. But let's start with your journey. From where do you hail? Where do you come from?
Well, I was born in Europe, which you may know from my accent. I was raised speaking Luxembourgish. I was born in Luxembourg, got my education in Luxembourg, and then I went to college in Germany. And so in Luxembourg, I learned German, I learned French. My English I learned later in life, of course, Luxembourgish. And I won't lose my accent. I keep speaking all these four languages still today. So my accent won't go away so quickly. I hired in, actually same company than Billy Taylor, hired in with Goodyear in Luxembourg, in the innovation center there, and then eventually got transferred to the United States and spent the major part of my career in the United States, but all my career was in innovation. And at the later, probably the last 15, 20 years of my career, I got drawn into lean thinking. How can we take advantage of all this lean, this good lean stuff that we do, that people do in manufacturing? How can we bring that into innovation and make it work in the creative part of the process? Actually, the upfront part, where all the creation is done, and of course, I learned very quickly, this is not about processes. This is about people. This is about engaging the people and changing the culture. And that was actually my main learning. And that is what I like to share the most today. I made all these mistakes. I went into engineering because I didn't like to work with people. I have to admit that. And I had this dream about engineering being you sit in a corner and on a computer and they leave you alone. And little did I know, okay? And I learned everything by making mistakes, learning it all the hard way. And that's why I love to share that experience today. And that's why I like opportunities like this.
So you hit a couple of words there or phrases I want to hit on. The first is culture change. Now, There's a lot of talk about culture change, but there isn't a whole lot of talk about what are we changing from and what are we changing to. So it's almost as if many people are thinking that we need culture change just for the sake of changing. And I don't necessarily subscribe to that. You know, we should be changing, you know, just like when we're thinking about continuous improvement, we're changing, right? When we're thinking about culture change, we should have a purpose in mind. Yes. So what's your opinion about culture change? What does that mean to you?
Well, that means culture is the way you work. Things that aren't even written. It's the way you are educated. You come to a company, you get educated. Your education is mostly by watching the other folks, what they are doing, and going along with the same, doing the same things, doing things the same way. And I grew up in a culture that was very military influenced. A lot of the leaders, actually, my first leaders came out of military careers, and it was like, I tell you what to do, and you go do it. And it was, don't ever make a mistake, always please the folks higher up. And all those good things that that you pick up, and you think that's the way you should work and the way you should operate. And I tried to do a lot of those things, but were never very successful with it, as I mentioned. And for me, the breakthrough came when I learned Lean, and actually not when I learned Lean principles. The breakthrough came when I studied right up on my own about other companies, amongst others, Toyota. And one thing that influenced me tremendously was John Shook's article about Noumi, how a company which was known to be one of the biggest, a site that was known to be one of the biggest challenges for GM at that time, became their best performing organization within a short period of time with a different culture that was brought in. And that's when I started to think about how can I bring this culture into an innovation environment. And I was already halfway through that transformation at that time. But I'm glad I learned it at that time, because it was the cultural part, the people part, that turned the things around and made them work.
Okay, so even in a militaristic culture, okay, people are still involved. So I understand why it is that you found that unattractive, because it was repressive, okay? What do you prefer? I mean, when you talk about, you know, a negative culture or a negative experience in a culture, and ultimately, you know, culture is who we are, right? It's our values, it's our beliefs, it's our, and what does a positive culture look like to you? So for changing from that to something else, what does the positive culture look like to you?
Yeah, it is a culture based on largely based on respect, and respecting individuals, respecting diversity, respecting the fact that not everybody thinks the same. And it's also based on humble leadership, servant leadership, where leaders get away from telling people what to do to asking people, hey, what do you think about? How should this be done? You're the expert on this. Tell me, and I support you, kind of culture. That, to me, helped get me started on it. Mm-hmm. It was especially the respect part. Yes, you can engage people by telling them what to do and creating fear so they do it. But you can also engage people by respecting them to make respecting them for their knowledge, for their experience, and let them come up with a way of doing things. And then they tell me how they think this is the best way to do it. And if I may learn something new, in most cases I did, but then when I understand what they are planning to do and it's a good thing, I will fully support it. And I hold them accountable to deliver what we agreed upon. And I also hold them accountable of coming to me as a leader if they have a problem, because I may be able to help them. And things may not work the way we agreed to do them. Well, then I hold them accountable to come to me and we change things. Mm-hmm. And again, when I know the new path, I support them on the new path. So that's kind of what I learned through many years.
Okay, so this is the real challenge. Say you have an organization that is... where the culture is, we'll call it negative, okay? Repressive, less respect for people, autocratic. And then somebody like you comes in and you're the servant leader. How do you get the people to abandon the old way of thinking and trust you and start to follow you?
Yeah, that is a good point. It is relatively easy with the people who do the work on the floor. I'm talking innovation now. They would do the work in the office, of course. You can very quickly get them engaged in this humble or servant leadership style, where you start asking them how to do things and so on and so on. The difficult part is with the leadership, and if you get the people, in my case in the office, and I had a big training program at Goodyear where we absolutely everybody had to go through that lean education. And that was a big part of the education, and we also trained future leaders in the same thinking, and that we were very successful with, because through my time at doing lean, I had people who came to my first lean class, and were 10 years later were senior leaders in innovation center. So that was a great way of doing that. The other part that I found extremely effective with leaders is the psychologists call it cognitive dissonance, and that's how I learned it from a friend of mine who's a lean leader, and he came out of psychology. That was his job. He was a clinical psychologist. And he trains people in that cognitive dissonance, which is actually, the psychologists say, it's the conflict in your brain between your behaviors and your beliefs. I always thought that you change the beliefs of the people and then they change the behavior. That's not the way the psychologists say. See, they say you change the behaviors and the beliefs will follow. And when I learned that, that worked extremely well with our leadership, because now I engaged the leaders in the training. So they they came and they taught lean values and call lean behaviors. And it was amazing how I saw their behaviors change. To me, that is an absolute, works a key when you want to work with leaders, and to go from, I tell you what to do, to you tell me what to do. That humble part. And they were happy about it. A lot of them were happy about it. I heard from one of the most aristocratic leaders he was known. He was a huge, big person too, very impressive personality. And it was all about, I know it and I tell you. And he came at the end of his retirement. He gave me a presentation that I used actually in my training, where he described how this change made him so much of a better leader. And I was really humbled when I saw that. And I used it from there on in my training classes at Goodyear, because people knew who I was talking about. And they said, well, if it worked for this gentleman, it will certainly, maybe there is something to it. Maybe I should try it too.
So how did you get introduced to Lean?
That is a longer story. Goodyear was in a huge big crisis in 2003, really big crisis, financial crisis, and had an enormous layoff and total reorganization afterwards. And I personally thought this is a good time for me to do something new. So I volunteered to get into Six Sigma. Six Sigma was big at that time. I got into Six Sigma and that was really the best time I've had in the company, I have to admit that. Six Sigma projects. And then we got a new vice president, and he had heard about Lean, and he asked me, he said, would you be interested in looking how we can use Lean in innovation center? And I said, absolutely no. I'm happy with what I'm doing. I heard about Lean. It's just going to create headaches, and it had been tried in the manufacturing organization, didn't work so well. I wanted no piece of it. So he asked me three times. And at the third time, I said, if I don't take this, I will never get asked for anything again. So I said, let's give it a try. And I'm happy I did, because it did work really well. And the amazing part, for me, the biggest thing was at the Goodyear Innovation Center, we got the AME Award for the Innovation Center.
All right.
The Manufacturing Excellence Award for an Innovation Center, where Lean wasn't supposed to work, okay? And it worked really, really, really well. And I wrote a couple of books about it. It was good for Goodyear. It was good for me. I'm glad I said yes the third time.
So that's a nice segue into innovation. You're very keen. Some people would say an expert on innovation excellence. And I certainly wouldn't dispute that with anybody or yourself. So talk about innovation excellence. You know, what does it mean? What does innovation excellence mean? And how did Lean come to play such a big part in your models and the way you rolled out innovation excellence?
Yeah, I have to say that, as I said, I spent my whole career in innovation. In fact, I got over 60 U.S. patents alone, or patents or trade secrets, and and I got all of those in a very short period where I did product design. The rest was all other things like Lean and working in other parts of the company, and we were very good in innovation at Goodyear. And in fact, I spent quite some time in a skunk works, like in an isolated organization that was just focusing on crazy stuff. And we were doing good. And I knew the process very well and had no problem finding those lean principles that worked. And what you have to understand is 70% of an innovation center is actually pretty much routine work. And that's the same in automotive, or some companies have a little less. And lean principles apply really well to that work. Flow, waste, all those things work really, really well there. But then if you want to expand from there and just become naturally or organically more innovative, you have to create an innovative culture, just like you create a lean culture to make it sustainable and to make it really very effective. Now, I found out very quickly that you can build an innovation culture extremely well on top of an innovative culture, because the people part is virtually the same. The engagement, the empowerment, all that helps you tremendously with your innovation culture. But you have to add a few new things that you have to bring in, and you have to bring them in through education, just like you brought lean principles in with education. And then you need to teach everybody in the company, leaders and associates, everybody, how innovation really works. You have to bring in a few of these key principles that, and I'm not just talking about creativity here, I'm talking about innovation. For me, innovation is a system where any idea that pops up anywhere gets treated correctly and based on its merits get developed, and you may actually and then it goes into production, it goes into service, it you collect money on it, and for me the process ends with the collection of the money and many years of sustained activity in the market. And you may even have to change the customers, you may even have to change the environment and so on. So that's all part of what I call an innovation system and innovation culture. And again, it all thrives on engagement, it thrives on respect, it thrives on diversity, and it thrives on humble leadership, a very big piece. But there are additional factors that come up, and one of them is, let me give you just two examples of stuff that that is new. The first one is the, okay, we all are taught you create value for the customer, but you have to think a lot broader on that customer. Henry Ford already said, if I had just asked the customer, they would have asked me for faster horses. So you have to really look at those opportunities, that technology that is out there, that that may create opportunities that the customer will never, your traditional customer is never going to ask for. And to re-engineer the customer and the market is something that companies may not know how to do it well. So that is a big thing of that education. And another one that absolutely killed me when I did innovation is fear. Fear of leadership. Fear of leadership to support innovation. The most company culture does not does not really encourage people to take that risk. At Goodyear, we had a amongst our five behaviors that everybody had to follow. By the way, which by the way is not very innovative. If it's only five of them and everybody follows those, you don't get much diversity. By the way, but one of the five was courage, but it was all totally misinterpreted. That courage to support something new, that wasn't there for many people. It's like you can only lose if you support the new stuff. You can make a bad career move. You can make the company lose money. You may lose reputation and so on and so on if it goes wrong. Of course, if it goes right, you could be a hero, but the chances for it to go right are not big enough for people to support it. So fear killed a lot of my new ideas for a very long time. And there again, lean brings in, especially what we learned from lean startup thinking, brings in a lot of new principles that can be used to overcome that fear. And getting that included in your innovation system, in your innovation culture, will do a lot to alleviate that fear. But there are other ways, of course.
So I have a couple of questions leading into that. you speak of lean quite a bit. Obviously, you're definitely a fan of it. It's unmistakable. However, when most people are writing or sharing about lean, they gravitate towards the lean tools, you know, 5S, correct, value stream mapping, Tact Time, you know, things of that nature. You haven't mentioned any of that. You've focused your attention or your emphasis on the softer skills, you know, the human endeavor, if you will, not the forensic tools. So, because when I think about innovation, all right, and I'm thinking about lean and innovation, I'm thinking, how can we apply standard work to innovation or for creativity? Or how can we have, value stream mapping for something that hasn't been created yet? And how do we know what the wait times are if it's the first time we were ever doing it? So these are things that, you know, and it's interesting that you are emphasizing the people side and not focusing on the tool set like, you know, many, I won't say most, but a great many lean practitioners focus on.
Yeah, that is a good point. In fact, I think just bringing in tools and finding a problem that the tools can solve for you has not been a very sustainable way of changing your culture to a lean or operational excellent culture, by the way. You talked about the tools. Tools come in when they are needed, and the people who work in the process, who understand it, they bring in the right tools when they need them. So that's for me the way to look at tools. A key part of innovation is the process. Mm-hmm. And I, in my first book, I'm quoting a good friend of mine, Sam Landers, who I worked with. Sam had his hands in every new product that Goodyear made, by the way. But Sam he hated process. Innovation cannot have a process. You cannot be creative using a process. And Sam, at the end, completely changed. And I quote him in my book about it. He said, well, the process actually help me with innovation. He said, I spent so much time on bad processes, and they took so much time away from me that I could have used to think and to do something creative. And he said, after that, man, I all of a sudden had time to do the right stuff. So that's one way of looking at it. But I also believe that innovation, like everything else, follows a process, believe it or not. And following the best possible process is just as important for innovation than following the best possible process for manufacturing. Except that for innovation, it may be harder to see it, to find it. In manufacturing, you go out and you see it. Right. You can walk through the innovation center at Goodyear. You won't see anything, okay? You see people on computers and sometimes people talking to each other, and that's it. So you really have to look at it a little bit differently to understand that process and to if you go about it the right way and a little patient, find a little... ask the people who do it to explain it to you. You can understand it. And there is a best possible process for it. Absolutely. And if you learn something to make that process better, by all means, you do it. There's just one big caveat that I want to throw in. And a good friend of mine at Ford kept telling me when they went through a rigid design process, innovation took a step back because they did not allow people to do anything that wasn't in the standards. And we learned a very long time ago at Goodyear, I mean, you have product standards, and they are very strict because you must sell a safe product. So there is no messing with the quality and the product standard. But you have to give innovators a chance to think outside that box of the standard. So we created a rule, if you develop something according to the standards, you just do minimum testing because you know the results of those tests. And while you do government and all those mandated tests, of course, But you can predict most of the rest. But if you want to do something innovative, hey, there is a protocol by which you have to do additional testing, sometimes a lot of additional testing, but you're allowed to do it. And people never shied back from doing that testing.
Right.
They just did it. And that was a very important part of keeping the new ideas going inside a very quality oriented organization.
So what have you been doing with yourself after Goodyear?
Well, after Goodyear, I had written a book, and I talked to a bunch of people who do consulting. And so I never advertised consulting. I've been helping a few companies here and there. I never advertised it. I did not want to go. I was offered second careers that was not on my priority list. I talked to one colleague, and she said, I asked her, what are you doing? And she said, well, you know, if somebody asks me for help, I always go help them. I'm not asking for money. I just go and help them. And whatever develops out of it, develops out of it. And I said, that may be the way I do it. So if somebody asks me for help, I do what I can to help them. If something develops from it, fine, and we'll see what we can do with it. But that's how I look at it. I do a lot of thinking. I do a lot of writing. I do publish here and there. I do a lot of education, supporting good organizations out there like the AME, Shingo. There's even a lean product development organization that I'm part of that I like to support. And I like to support their activities because that's how I can get my message out. And that's why I'm so thankful about opportunities like this. They help me share what I learned so that people may not have to go through that enormous learning curve that I had to go through. Because learning curves, when it comes to people, are extremely long and frustrating sometimes. That's right. Probably very well known.
Right. And what happened, what works in one geography might not work in another geography,
Absolutely.
Not, in fact. So, you know, I applaud you because, you know, people ask me, you know, I just recently reached the sixth floor, so I'm 60 years old. I've just turned 60. And people say, geez, what are you going to do when you retire? And I'm like, you know, I'm going to do pretty much the same thing I've always done because that's what I enjoy doing. You know what I mean? Helping people, problem solving. My job, as your job did, afforded you the opportunity to see different places, meet different people, work different problems. It was never the same day twice. Those are things that excite me. I don't know what I would do. Maybe I'll do less. Maybe I'll be like you. I won't work as intensely, but you know, maybe I'll do a little bit less, but I think I'd have to stay in the game because I enjoy the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of my messages that is still not out there, people have not understood how much excellence or lean or excellent thinking can do for their innovative processes, systems, or whatever they have. I believe since it drives everything, that's Toyota says that they knew this a long time ago, 90%, 95% of the profits from a new vehicle, those decisions, I mean, what creates that profit, those decisions are made when the vehicle is designed. And that's where I want to put the lean thinking. And if you understand it and put it there correctly, you can make an enormous difference top and bottom line. And I think a lot of companies have not understood that. I saw it work at Goodyear. I really saw it. I wasn't able to publish all the finances behind it and so on, but I did see it and I can witness to it.
So maybe you can consult with the automotive industry on how to make a oil filter accessible by a human being without having to remove the entire engine. I remember, you know, I used to be able to change my own oil, just go down there, reach for it, twist it off and put the new one on. And now it's,
You didn't even have to open the hood for it.
right. Now it's a huge challenge. So maybe that'll be the next project. We can get you over to the automotive designers and say, hey, let's make it so that an oil change doesn't cost $300.
In 10 years, there won't be an oil change anymore because everybody will drive electric vehicles. So
yeah.
That's my forecast. Not everybody, but a lot of
people. Yeah. You still need some heavy-duty machines out there in the ocean, I would guess.
Absolutely. And the oil change will be replaced by other nuisances.
So I have one question to ask. I sometimes ask this of my guests, and before we wrap up here, first off, I'd like to thank you for your taking the time today. It's been a very enlightening conversation. But the one question I want to ask is, what one person do you, whoever it might be that exists now or in the past, do you look up to, and why?
Oh boy, that is a difficult question. I have a lot of respect I'm trying to focus it to what we talked about here and the more narrow focus.
Yeah.
And let me give you two examples. One person that I think set the stage for a lot of this many years ago is a person like Gandhi. I mean, talking about having no chance to do what he tried to do and using humility and influence to get it done is something that a lot of leaders today could look at. I also have a lot of respect for people like Jim Womack and John Chuck, because they were the first to come in with this new thinking and to get that message. I know how unbelievably difficult it is to get a message like this out. And I think they had to do the really hard work to get it out. And I have a lot of respect for that kind of work, because I did it myself for the innovation piece. And I did it at a company who that was not on their agenda at all, that lean stuff, okay? I had a senior leader stand up and say, hey, this is all, there's nothing new here. This is all baloney. We tried this before. The faster we get rid of this stuff, the better it is for everybody. And right to my face. And at that time, nobody stood up for me yet. And and I also had a senior leader of a company that should be a leader in innovation. He was the technical, the chief technical officer of that company, saying, "Lean is a tool. I wouldn't even touch it with a 10-foot pole," he said. That's why I think that was a major challenge. I did it myself. I learned from them. I think those people deserve a lot of credit. And the amazing part, they got most of it right. In spite of everything else, that's still amazing to me today. So.
Well, listen, Norbert, it's been a great pleasure having you today on my State of Readiness podcast. I wish you all the best and success in your helping and being altruistic to others in need. I really appreciate the time and that you've invested with me today. So thank you very much.
Thank you for letting me share my thoughts.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.